Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest is the poet Maureen McGranigan. Maureen McGranigan is a poet, playwright, and novelist. Her poetry chapbook, Attached to Earth, was published in 2011 by Finishing Line Press, and her plays have been performed in several cities. She teaches playwriting and screenwriting at Pittsburgh Kappa and holds degrees in writing from Carnegie Mellon University and Trinity College, Dublin. Hi, Maureen.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Do you want to start us off with some poems?
Sure. And actually, I'd like to say a quick word about the cover photo, which I know they can't see, but I'll describe it briefly. It was taken by a local photographer, Deborah Hosking, and I think that it represents the central theme of the book really beautifully, which is this sort of juxtaposition of the sacred and the earthly and how they exist in one another and inform one another and are two sides of the same coin, really. And it's a photo of a group of angel figurines in the window of a home, and you can see reflected behind and above them the house across the street, which is a very a humble dwelling, an older home, it looks like, with a chimney kind of poking up into the blue and pink cloudy sky. So I think it gets that those two things really exactly. And I'm very gracious to Deborah Hosking for letting me use it. So definitely check out her work around town. She exhibits a lot. And the first poem I'll read is called Not With a Bang. And it doesn't require a whole lot of introduction. It's basically the musings of an evening gathering of images and impressions at the end of the day with some solemnity and some foreboding. But I will say that the title comes from T.S. Eliot's poem, The Hollow Men, the last stanza of which repeats the line, "This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper." And the poem isn't as ominous as all that. But I think it's true that many of our days don't have a particularly dramatic conclusion. Just this quiet, questioning, perhaps pensive passage into night. So this is Not With a Bang. Dishcloth cloaks sink's nozzle. Beyond my shuttered window, the sickle moon tapers to lethal points, and a squirrel that fixed me with a stare, sly or charming, sleeps in the hollow of a tree. My sour-faced companion on the bus smelled of sweat. I disembarked, crossed the bridge. Lamplit streets wound through ridge and hollow, night's illuminated networks. Dead leaves scratched against the street, horn bleats, two near collisions. At home, I sliced my thumb cutting cucumbers. Blood dried brown on flowered napkin and dish towel, dinner's wreckage filled the sink. Red ribbons curled amidst the suds. Who skirted death tonight? Was it me? Lights, sweat, leaves, bleats, limp cloth, empty sink, the squirrel, the moon. And I dedicated the chapbook to my parents, Mark and Kathy, so I thought I would read a poem about each of them. And the poem I chose about my father is called A Dream About My Father, and it's a brief poem that actually comes from a dream that I once had about him, similar in tone, I think, to Not With a Bang, pensive musing. He's an electrical engineer, but I think the soul and the sensitivity of a poet. Stephen Dunn's work in particular makes me think of him, the attitude and the outlook he might have had if he had devoted his life to writing as opposed to engineering. And he's a reticent man, ultimately. I've always had a good relationship with him, but not a particularly voluble one. And I remember one time when we came back from one of his business trips that he had taken me on, he told my mother I was a good traveling companion, which I think is because we were able to be silent with each other comfortably. And so this is A Dream About My Father. He bought a convertible, and we explored silence from coast to coast. In Santa Fe, we climbed through the eye of a rock into his computer, touring power quality studies, proposals, and poems snatched from 9 to 5. I wanted a piece of abstracted memory for souvenir, but woke up empty-handed. A cold click ends it. This all I remember, and even this embellished. And for my mother, I wrote a poem called Mom's Final Wishes, which comes from an incident when I was an adolescent in which she revealed very offhandedly and informally that she wanted to be cremated after she died. And this was disturbing to me at the time, though when I look back on it, I find that I find it quite wonderful because she's treating death in this very cavalier and fearless manner with humor. And it's comforting to me, actually, in retrospect. So, Mom's final wishes. She wants to go out clean with a flame. Tells me over laundry, bath towels, and turtlenecks. Why does she talk about it as if it's on the calendar with the lunch menu and her manicure? Great, I say. A pile of ash, your legacy. I shake out a wrinkled shirt. What's the point, she asks, all these bodies buried everywhere? I tell her, whole new meaning to throwing yourself away. She'll make an urn in ceramics. You can keep me on the mantle. Your children can knock me over. Look, Grandma's all over the floor again. Sweep her up. I take my stack of towels, huff to stairs top. There'd be less and less of her every time, more and more in the dustbuster. Ashes to ashes, dust to dustbuster. Maybe I'll spread her on the ocean. Or better yet, sprinkle her in her family's fields. Ride the little metal seat behind the tractor. Plant Mom with the tomatoes. I'll read Catechism, The Bees, which is also a poem from childhood. And catechism was a word that always held a certain mystique for me. When you grow up Catholic, you hear it a lot, but it's never really defined for you until later. And then there's the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which purports to be the authority on everything that matters, these huge cosmic questions. But its definition is actually very simple. It just means instruction, particularly oral instruction, question and answer. Though that process, I think, especially when you apply a word like this to it, becomes very powerful and meaningful and even sacred in a way. And this is an instance of a child trying to figure things out and discovering through persistent question and answer one of the little horrors of the natural world. So Catechism, The Bees. She withdraws the dripping comb, bees clinging to netted hat, gloves. Do we eat that? I ask. This is raw, she says. What is raw? I strain to see honey forming beneath brown jittering. A hive has mostly workers, one queen and some drones. What are drones? I ask Mom. She puts a finger to her lips. I repeat the ugly word, drones. The woman smiles. Drones fertilize the eggs. What does fertilize mean? People laugh. Inside the case, bees buzz. They're the dads, Mom whispers. And then the woman, after they fertilize the eggs, they're stung to death. You mean they kill them? Mother's finger on her lips again. I search for a doomed drone dad. Even better, an execution. That night in the cabin, I consider telling Dad, what will he say? That's tough. Glad we're not bees. I'm really glad for him. Then I wonder, do they know? Try to fly away. Cry. Buzz. All their honey-making friends, stingers out, closing in.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Maureen McGranigan, reading from her chapbook, Attached to Earth. Maureen, I want to ask you about the ordinary in your work.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's expressed through the description with an attention and almost reverence, and I just wanted to ask you about that.
Yes, well, I feel like that's where the spiritual and the sacred and the ethereal resides, in homely details and earthy details, and also where a lot of drama is as well. I teach writing, and I tell my students that the universal is in the particulars. We're always going to identify more with a character the more specific things we know about them, because even though they may not be the same specifics of our lives, our lives are all made up of details. There's just small details, some of which are the same and some of which are different. But that's where we find meaning in those things, as opposed to the abstractions. We pay a lot of lip service to the abstractions, but in fact, what we really know are all of these are the things that we see every day, or the small things that we notice that catch our attention.
How does that work in your composition? How do you go about paying attention to those details and working them into your poetry?
I think a lot of poems start with the details or the situation in some cases. If there's a dramatic situation that I'm interested in exploring, like the one in the apiary, then I'll start to tell that story to myself. But the more I tell it, or as I tell it over and over again, as the poem goes through multiple revisions, I'm always looking for the details and thinking about the moments that make it up. But a lot of poems begin with the details, some kind of intriguing detail, either an image or a sound or a description in some cases of something. And that's what gets me writing to begin with.
I noticed a lot of really nice sensory detail with the smell of the person on the bus, mm-hmm. and the silence in the car. And those are things that sort of come through these poems and they linger. And then that's sort of what hooks you and makes you come back in to wonder about how that's representing the poem's mm-hmm. appreciation for the importance of that.
Yes, and I think that that's what one thing that poetry as a genre does, perhaps better than any of the others, really focuses on these details. They can be the story in a poem, in a fiction piece or in a play. They're part of something so much larger, and they're in the service of something so much larger. But in the poem, they can be center stage. It's really about that, about illuminating those tiny things.
Absolutely. That word illuminating sounds really spot on for this idea of connecting the sacred and the ordinary. Can you read us some more?
Sure. In fact, on that theme of the sacred and the ordinary, I'd like to read the poems that make up sort of the centerpiece of the book. It's a cycle of poems about Jesus and Peter. And in the way of introduction, I'd like to say that Peter is one of my favorite people in the Bible because he's so eager and zealous and impulsive, which makes him both Christ's protege and also his problem child, who's always falling on his face, putting his foot in his mouth, and acting very impulsively. He has to be reined in a lot. But I think that makes him endearing, and I think it makes their relationship rather charming, because there is this back and forth, almost like a parent and a child. And one thing that I think about a lot in terms of biblical characters and religious things is the ordinary. How are they like us? What were their daily lives like? So these poems imagine their relationship. There are some from Christ's perspective, some from Peter's perspective, and a couple from an omniscient perspective that kind of put them in a contemporary setting. They're mostly short, so I will read the cycle. And it ends on a poem that takes place on Easter. Jesus and Peter. 1. Casting the nets. I drifted out to sea, preaching from tired decks, the men silent, except one. He whistled in the morning sun, stowing nets. Cast them once more, I said. We've been at it all night, he replied. Nothing. Cast them, I said. He tilted his head like an animal or child. I watched the landscape of his arms, furrows and ridges, sun brown and weather beaten, his face contorted with the work. I heard a cock crow. My palms burned. I saw him upside down. They hit the deck, a wet, rank hailstorm. I put my arm before my face. Scaly creatures piled up around my ankles, their faces blank. 2. At the pool in Galilee. The 12 lounge in matching bathing trunks, hairy chests, indistinguishable in 12 pairs of shades. Only Christ is fully dressed. He climbs to the high board, loses a sandal. They watch him walk to the edge and off. The depths gather him, splashless. Peter leaps to his feet. I want to try it. He scrambles up, throws himself head first. The pool below is empty. Lord, save me, he cries, and finds himself on the side, dry. Jesus points. Will you get me that denarius on the bottom? The surface wavers over the coin. Where did all this water come from? Peter asks. Christ sighs. 3. After Lazarus was raised. After the unwrapping, hugs, tears, party, drinks, he turns some water to wine off the books. He lies there, wide awake, thinking about Lazarus, then scourges, thorns, a cross, a hill. Father? He sits up into silence, wine-soaked slumber, wakes Peter, who mumbles, half asleep, that won't happen. We would never let that happen. Get behind me, Satan. 4. In the coffee shop. A double espresso and a double espresso decaf. Peter and Christ sit down. Why decaf? Peter asks. I don't like caffeine, Christ says. Is it sinful? Christ sips, sighs. No. He shaves lemon into his cup. Why did you become a fisherman? He asks. My dad was a fisherman. Christ nods. Hey, is that why you decided to be God? What? Nothing. Joke. I get it. You never laugh, Peter says. Why not? Christ puts down his cup. I don't know. Oh, come on. You're God. You know everything. You know how to cure blindness with mud. Teach me to do that. Christ folds his arms, leans on the table. It's not a magic trick. Sunlight streams into Starbucks, illuminating coffee cake crumbs. Peter picks up an abandoned newspaper. Romans burning cities, marching across the continent. Bloody bastards. You're telling me, Christ says. Is it sinful to laugh? Peter asks. Will you stop asking me that? Sorry. Please stop being sorry all the time. Sorry, I mean, you want to hear something funny? I keep dreaming about a cock crowing. Oh, Peter. What? What? Drink your coffee. 5. Why I denied him. Because we all knew about the Romans, how they hung you up to suffocate over many scorching days and freezing nights, because I was just a fisherman, a fish for crying out loud, because Satan jumped into my head, yeah, that's it, Satan, because I hate being stared at, because I still sometimes think about a woman and a child, a son to take out on the boat, hauling in nets all night, no words or word, because the fire was warm, because the darkness was a cloak, because I forgot that cocks crowed. And lastly, 6, on the third day. The cock crows, ugly sound. I awake from dreams of floating ears, bloody feet. In the street they sell leavened bread, Passover past, rotten palm fronds everywhere. She calls, take John out, he's beside himself. Isn't he supposed to be taking care of her? We walk to the water. Why did I ever sell my boat? Why did I not slip beneath the waves that stormy night? Here comes Mary, shouting, these women. Sure enough, empty, no stench, no body, wrappings neatly folded, tidy little grave robbers. John in the corner puts the headcloth to his face. Poor kid. But then his eyes flame. Peter, he says. Peter, 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 Peter.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Maureen McGranigan. Well, now I have lots of things to ask you. One of the things I'm really wondering about your work is how you work with humor. There are a lot of moments of nice humor in these mm-hmm. poems, with the questions from the child in the apiary, and a lot in this cycle, particularly mm-hmm. with the, come on, you're God, and... just these moments of, you know, off the books, like mm-hmm. sort of a side humor. And then also, I wouldn't say punchline, but like given more weight with things like Christ's sighs. Mm. Can you talk about that? How you work with humor?
Yeah, I think a lot of humorous moments are found. They're hard to manufacture. And I've done a lot of thinking recently about, you know, how do you write comedy? Because we talk about that in class a lot. The kids want to write comedy. And I find that it's difficult because humor is something that sneaks up on you. But a lot of humor comes out of situation and a lot of humor comes out of character. And I find that people, I think more than they realize, communicate with each other through humor. They have a lot of interpersonal jokes or in jokes, things that based on their understanding of one another that just come up and are naturally funny and they don't even think about it. So I find that by including dialogue, and I work a lot with dialogue in my poems, I think partly because I'm a dramatist, but I find that in some ways naturally creates humorous moments because two people that know each other quite well have that built in a way. And that's one thing that I wanted to create with Jesus and Peter was a sort of intimacy and a shared a shared humor would be part of that, I think.
Is that something that I'm curious about, the your choice of subject for this cycle? Because mm-hmm. it's a big subject,
right? Yeah.
And that seems like a lot to take on. And I'm interested mm-hmm. in the approach that you took. Mm. The voice in the poems is very immediate. It's very intimate.
Mm.
And you do have that humor that happens. But you also have these moments of gravity and this kind mm-hmm. of sustained hauntedness with the dreams and the nightmares and the sort of premonitions of crucifixion mm-hmm. that come in. I guess I'm curious what moved you to take on that approach, how you decided on that approach and mm-hmm. what moved you to that subject.
I think the first poem that I wrote was the one at the pool in Galilee, which is a retelling or a reimagining of the scene when Christ walks on water and Peter decides he wants to walk on water, but then he starts to sink. And I suppose when I started imagining that, I just thought it would be funny if Christ and his apostles were hanging out at the pool one day. But of course,
And their matching bathing suits
and their shades, you know. But they're never just hanging out. There's always some spiritual lesson involved, no matter what's going on, how simple a day it is. So they don't really get a day off from spiritual revelation. So there has to be some kind of incident. I thought, well, maybe I could see Christ languidly going off the diving board, and then Peter's like, "Oh, that looks like fun." But of course, you know, he has this crisis where there's no water in the pool, and Christ saves him, but then he realizes that he would have been fine anyway. That was the first poem that I wrote, and then I was just intrigued by that relationship, and I wanted to explore it more. And I think on a lot of separate occasions, I started drafting poems about them without even a sense at first that they would go together. But then I had this collection of them, and then there were a couple that I wrote specifically because I knew I had a cycle kind of coming together. But it begins with this imagining them in unusual situations. And I remember the whole coffee shop poem started with this idea that they're hanging out one day and discussing why they decided to become what they became and how their fathers were the reason for it. And Christ, Christ is God because Dad is God. And Peter's a fisherman because that's
business.
What Dad did.
Yeah.
It runs in the family.
And it seems, in terms of your collection, mm-hmm. You started us off with poems about accessing the sacred through the ordinary. And mm-hmm. so this is an interesting turn that happens sort of in the center of the collection where you mm-hmm. go into these stories that are sacred for so many people and make them ordinary.
Yes, and I feel like they were always being told that Christ was fully human. And so what does that mean? That means that it was full of all these his life was full of all these mundane details and moments that aren't recorded where they weren't doing much or they were just chatting. And I'm intrigued by that because it makes him real in a way. And it's just interesting and fun, I think, to think about him and these people who are apocryphal in many ways, but historical too.
Can you read us some more work?
Sure. I thought I would read another poem about a biblical figure that's not published that I wrote more recently, Noah, who was the sole survivor of an apocalypse, and so I think someone you probably all think about from time to time. And who managed to survive by some strange foresight and planning that I wanted to imagine what it would be like if we were in that situation and we thought this was going to happen and we were charged with this ridiculous task or seemingly ridiculous task. It's called If There's Ever Another Flood. We all intend to be Noah. But that would mean plundering our portfolios, selling our houses, quitting our jobs, liquidating our children's college funds, investing all our capital in lumber and our time in construction, and building, on faith, not even a whim or a vision, a wooden ship, caulking it too, making it seaworthy. Who knows how many permits we'd need, palms we'd have to grease. And if no rain came, we'd be out of luck, bankrupt and homeless, forced to live in our monstrosity. A great echoing home illegally docked that would soon rot and leak and be possessed by our creditors, for whom it might come in handy should the storm start a few years later than expected. On the street, we'd be the first to drown. And I have a couple other poems that are new that haven't been published yet, and I wanted to read this one, which is a scene from a Pittsburgh scene, and I'm calling it, for lack of a better title at this point, ineluctable modality, which is just a fancy phrase from Ulysses, in which from the section of which Stephen, the protagonist, is wandering around with his eyes closed, because he wants to see, or he's thinking about the fact that the world is still there even when he can't see it, and ultimately is still there even when he's not there. So this is a poem about how things come to exist personally for us by our direct experience of them. So, ineluctable modality. Someone said the only things you can be certain exist are those you experience directly. So, now I know this park on Pittsburgh's north side is. So does my dog, trotting down by the fence before the railroad tracks. Gus's snow cone stand also is. And Gus himself, gray-bearded, and the blue and red bulbs of ice that stain the tongue and lips. His wife, Yaya, scoops peanuts. Children play on the tennis courts with balls but no rackets, and their mothers lounge on benches. Yeah, I think she in jail, one says. Ain't no one heard from her in months. I watch a woman with braids for hair kick a styrofoam cup across the street, her big hips swinging. Suddenly, something else comes into being, a giant pug-nosed engine whistling hard. Hee, hee, doodong, 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 doodong. My dog stands tall, ears perked like a retriever, then launches himself into barking motion. The children pay their respects more solemnly, balls still while the train passes. Nothing changes about the women, or Gus, or Yaya. The train only a tired song. I put my nose into the bag of peanuts like a horse and inhale deeply. It's almost better than the shelling and eating. When I look up, the noisy visitor has clacked away. It exists now, too. But what of the freight yards framing its journey? What of the destinations of its various goods? What of the worlds it passes through? This stretch of tracks is real enough, and my dog nosing quietly again, and the kids return to their games, and their mothers, minus one friend, plus peanuts and snow cones, Gus and Yaya, and that woman with her styrofoam cup. Well, I think I will finish with the last poem in the chapbook. I find it's always a good bookend. It's also an unusual poem for me. It's the only poem I ever wrote about running, even though I was a competitive runner for about 15 years or more. I ran in high school and college and for several years after that before a knee injury kind of sidelined me. But strangely enough, I've written very little about it. I guess it got compartmentalized away, or it's hard to get perspective on. But I did see a photo of myself once doing it, and the fact that there are moments when you're running, every stride actually, when you're completely elevated, moved me to write this. On seeing a photo of myself running, I gasped to see myself midair, defying those black arrows that pointed to the Earth's red core in all my grade school science books. I remember only mud and puddles my feet plumbed, eyes straining after rival uniforms, their colors spattered black and blurred. The camera could have clicked half a second before or after, found me wallowing in the marsh. But this is what's preserved, one of my rapid heartbeats, unattached to Earth. Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. The poetry of Maureen McGranigan. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody, 90.5 FM.